All of the government programs that we don't like are funded by theft. All of the government programs that we do like... Oh, sorry, there aren't any. Government is the reason that healthcare is expensive. Government is the reason you can't go to college. Taxation is theft.
And welcome back to Taxation is Theft, the show that talks about all the ways the government is ripping you off and screwing you with your own money. Broadcasting live on Facebook and YouTube from an underground bunker deep within the jungles of Mexico at an undisclosed location. I'm Dan Taxation is Theft Berman, former candidate for president of the United States, currently in the race for governor of Texas. And tonight I have Brian Nichols, host of, you're not going to believe this, The Brian Nichols Show at BrianNicholsShow.com. That's such an amazing coincidence that his show and his name just happened to be the same name. It's amazing. It's mind-blowing. Before we get started, if you're watching the live streams, please make sure to share, invite your friends, start a watch party. Do whatever you can to spread the word, because we're going to be talking, especially tonight, I know sometimes we talk about some really boring shit that you've heard a million times about how much taxes suck, but tonight we've actually got some really, really interesting topics. We're going to talk about how to introduce libertarianism to people who don't want to hear about libertarianism or liberty. Introducing this to new people, reaching people that are usually unreachable. So you're going to want to hear this, so make sure to tag your friends and share this. And of course, during the show, while you're listening to this and while you're feeling inspired to hate the IRS and all these other tax collecting agencies, head over to taxationistheft.info and support us by buying some swag, like this really cool hat that I have on that you cannot see if you're listening to the podcast. But if you're listening to the podcast, you need to head over to YouTube and subscribe, of course. Anyways, on to the show. Brian Nichols, welcome. I'm doing awesome. So I want to start the show out before we get into it. Which tax do you hate the most?
Enthusiastically, again, I hate property tax, because why would you pay taxes for something you already own?
Absolutely. But it's and we say the same thing about, like, the vehicle taxes and you know, things like that. But it's like, even with vehicle taxes, you can say, okay, I'm not going to use my car. You can park it in the garage. I mean, right. I used it anyway. But, you know, park it in the garage and not have to pay that just to keep it. But with property, you can't do that.
Right. You just kind of, you know, live where we live.
Yeah. And property tax, I always like to say, is the one, you know, while people are out there saying income tax is slavery because you're selling, you're, you know, they get to keep part of your labor. Yeah, but it's more like getting mugged on the way home from work. Yep. I like to say property tax is the real slavery, because if it weren't for the property tax, you could live on your land and nature provides everything you need. But the king comes along and says, I need some shiny metal pieces. Go into town and get a job and work for somebody to earn those shiny metal pieces so you can earn the right to stay on that land.
Yep. No, bingo.
Yeah, that's the worst one, man.
Property tax sucks. No, I'm not a big fan. Now, and you know what's wild, too, is how disproportionate it can be just by area. I had a gentleman on my show who's running for a legislator in Long Island. And Long Island, their property taxes, I think, on average, is like 70% higher than the national average just because it's in Long Island. And just to think that just because you own a home on Long Island that you're being basically penalized, right? You're being fined by the government for owning that land. It is truly like it is a negative incentive. It's a perverse incentive. Like, why would I want to own land if I'm going to get punished by the government? But yeah, it's truly like, why, like, you can then take that and extrapolate it down to its like nth degree. It's like, well, am I going to be taxed for my cell phone? Am I going to be taxed for, you know, my cigarettes? Oh wait, you know, they are doing that. And it's kind of like the precipice, the property tax. It gives them, you know, that initial domino to push down to start the entire chain of taxation.
Right. And this one, I mean, cause we're going to get into talking about this, but I think this is a really interesting one that we can use to connect with lefties, because lefties typically they don't care about property tax, right? They're like, I don't own a home, I'm renting, I have a landlord. Yeah, tax his ass, right?
Right.
And forget about the fact that, like, yeah, that's going to raise your rent. Consider the fact that a lot of these lefties, their parents or grandparents or great-grandparents might have owned land that they might have inherited and still have today if it weren't for property taxes that they couldn't afford because they got reassessed over the last 100 and something years. Inheritance taxes that would have stripped that from them. We had this is a perfect example in a personal story. My grandfather had been working all his life, and it's funny because he would like sit there. He was kind of like a Bernie Sanders, like, oh, these millionaires. But it was funny because he was actually a millionaire, but he wasn't like, you know, the evil capitalist. He was a carpenter. He just worked all his life saving and saving and saving and being smart with his money. And, you know, all that turned into being worth over $1 million. And he bought this house for probably $50,000 in Los Angeles that by the time they had both passed, it was worth about $1 million.
Wow.
And if we wanted to keep it in the family, so in California, they have like this, you know, you pay property tax based on the date that you bought it. So now it's worth like 20 times more than what they bought it. Our property tax would have been 20 times what they were paying. And it would have been something like $1,500 a month if we just wanted to keep that house in the family that had already been in the family for 40 years.
Wow.
It's absolutely insane. And we're not even talking inheritance tax or anything like that. So ultimately we had to sell the house, which is a shame.
Wow. That's sad.
Yeah. Yeah. It really fucking sucks. And I know a lot of the lefties are going to be like, yeah, well, you know, who cares about you? I'm still struggling to pay my rent. And it's like, yeah.
That's part of the problem. Come on.
Exactly. I mean, and here's the other thing too, because this plays into like the minimum wage, right? So all this has been stripped away from me. That means I'm struggling just like you to pay my rent now. So now I have to compete with you for jobs, which means I'm going to be in the market. Well, I can work harder than him and I'll work for less than him. And so therefore all the wages come down. But imagine if all of these people who they hate because, oh, they've been saving and they can retire early. I hate those people. Let's tax all the money. No, let them keep all their money. Let them leave the workforce. And now all the employers are like, oh my God, it's so hard to find good work around here. I would pay $20 an hour if I could just find somebody who could flip burgers right. Like, that would happen.
There it is.
I mean,
yes.
Not for burgers. They'd find robots for that, of course. But for all these other jobs, like there are so many jobs that like if people left the workforce, like they would be fighting for more people to fill these jobs, and they'd be willing to pay more. Now, you'd probably have to be a little bit more responsible because you know they still want to get their money's worth.
Right.
But the point is, they would be begging for you to work for them instead of right now. If you got to make your rent, you are begging them for the job, and you're willing to take whatever they're paying.
Exactly.
Yeah. They have taken away the in learning to negotiate. What is your strongest bargaining chip? The ability to just walk away.
Yeah.
And property
tax for sure
has stripped you of that. You can't even do it. Can't walk
away.
No
autonomy. No autonomy whatsoever. No, you're 100% right, Dan.
Man. All right. Well, let's dive in. So you've been trying to crack the code. How do we deliver liberty to people who are not necessarily thinking about liberty?
It's tough. And there is no right or wrong answer, right? It's what works. And what I've found has been working thus far has been really focusing on selling liberty. And I know there's like this like instant like gut punch when you hear the word sales. And I think that's just years of snake oil salesman, you know, that kind of mentality, the used car salesman. But really, we kind of need to reclaim the identity that is sales and being a sales professional. And the reason being is because everything in life is sales at the end of the day. You're either selling yourself, you're selling an idea, you're selling a product, a service, and you need to be able to instill value in whatever it is that you're selling to the consumer, right? So when we're talking about libertarians and libertarian ideals, we have to meet people where they're at in the conversation that they're already having in their own minds. And I think too often libertarians, we've been really focused on making sure people know how right we are versus addressing the issues that really matter to people, right? So I'm looking right now.
They just jump right into the Federal Reserve. It's all the Federal Reserve.
They sure, yeah, and you know what? There's going to be some folks that argument, it definitely empathizes with them, right? And they'll listen, but it's going to be a smaller fraction. And I would say that the people maybe who are interested in the Federal Reserve argument, a majority of them probably already on board. But you need to meet people where they're at. Like, what's the issue? What's the bed bug issue that they have in their life? And I would say right now, where we drop the ball across the board is talking about the lockdowns. And we're seeing it right now. I would love to see, you know, Libertarian Party headquarters take over this narrative away from the GOP and truly be the you know, individual liberty, anti-lockdown party. We lost that argument in the 2020 election, and I don't understand why we're still letting it, you know, run away, because this is an issue that's not just going to impact people in the immediate. This is going to have long-lasting negative consequences that are going to be destroying generations in the future. I mean, not only are we seeing generational wealth absolutely crumbling because of the lockdowns destroying family businesses like restaurants and bars, but also we're seeing an uptick in other unintended health consequences. We're seeing an uptick in cancer cases because there's been a drop in cancer screenings. We've seen an increase in suicide, depression. We've seen drug overdoses skyrocket. So we are starting to see there's a very real number that we can associate to the deaths of unintended consequences as a result of policy that's been taken, or in some cases that has not been taken. But I would say more focused than not, it's been the lockdowns harming real people. And we need to be able to not only address that as libertarians, but by and large, we need to be able to look at any other issue, right? When you're talking to the demographic that you're talking to, and really focus it is, and this is the Scott Horton approach, right? Meet the left from the left and the right from the right. And you have to do that, because if you're coming in trying to preach, you know, free market economics to somebody from the left, you're instantly starting off on a completely different, you know, foundation of concepts of beliefs, right? Whereas if you're able to start, you know, with a conversation from somebody on the right who's maybe more, you know, sympathetic to free market principles, then you can at least try to you know, peel back that onion and find where it is you have some common ground and then build on that common ground. But we don't get there by preaching to people. We get there by asking them about the things that matter to them and then taking that and applying liberty to their individual lives.
Right. Exactly. And this is like, I always use this, this reference. I don't know if you've seen, there's a TED talk about the best pasta sauce.
No.
Where, okay. So, I'll try to tell the short version of it. TED talks are short anyway, but, this guy was working for a marketing company, that like, it was like Prego or Ragu or like one of these really massive, pasta companies. Pasta sauces, and they were trying to figure out, they were like doing all this market research, trying all these different combinations, which pasta sauce can we put into that testing room where every single person who tries it is going to say that's the one. And they couldn't find one, and what they realized was, oh, there is no perfect pasta sauce. Different people have different tastes, and so therefore we have to have 10 different pasta sauces. And when people choose the ones that they like, they'll say, oh yeah, I like cheese, I like the cheesy one, that one's good. I like mushrooms. I like onions. Like that, whatever. Garlic. And so that's what they do now. And this is the same. This is the same model with, you know, you look at Doritos. You look at, you know, any of these things you have. And it's really interesting how they brand them too. And I've got a bag of chips here because I was eating them because I'm being a fat ass. But like, they like the different flavors have a different bag because they know, like, instinctually you're going to go like, just like, oh, I remember the green bag. That's the one I like. It burns it into your brain.
Didn't Doritos actually just do a commercial? So Doritos just did a commercial, and the commercial had zero name or brand identification. So all they did was they had the bag. They had the red bag and the blue bag, right? And they didn't mention the name Doritos. They didn't have the actual logo. They just had the bags throughout the commercial. And the entire commercial was focus on the fact that, you know, how is it that you know so much about this delicious, you know, cheesy chip based on just the bag alone? That right there, I think that's actually speaking exactly to what you're talking about, because people do, and think about it, this actually extrapolates beyond bags of chips, it goes to politics too. You have like this instinctual reaction to red team, blue team. That's why not only do you see that the presidential colors have that, but also, you know, when they're on stage and they're having the ties, that's all entirely done on purpose. You're speaking to subtle things. Dan Brown, he's from the UK, and he's, I think he's an illusionist is his official title. But there was an amazing series he used to do back in the mid-2000s. I forget the name of the series. It's driving me crazy. But there was one, I'll call it a skit, basically, where basically he was going to bring in these marketing professionals. And these marketing professionals were driven from their hotel that he paid for them. He drove them to the studio, and they go through and he's like, okay, here's what, you know, the campaign is, right? The campaign is going to be it's going to be a taxidermy place for people for their pets, and that's all he tells them. So he leaves them with that information, and they start, crafting, they start drawing, and they're workshopping and trying to think of what they want to do for the marketing campaign. They come to an agreement that they're going to do this like a stuffed bear, and it's going to be near the gates of heaven, with little, rainbows in the background and angel wings. So they start to sketch this design. About an hour or so goes by, and Dan Brown comes back in. And he goes, okay, what'd you guys come up with? And they show him the design. And he goes, interesting. Here, let me show you what I had from my idea. And he flips open a notebook that he had, and it's almost a spitting image of exactly what they drew. And the guys, the marketing guys are all, oh my God, what was that? And they cannot believe that that's exactly what they had come up with. So then at the very end of the video, they go back to the beginning from when they got into the car and they drove to the headquarters to do this campaign. And throughout the entire trip, you'll see there are subtle drops of little hints that are completely subconscious. So they drove past these pearly gates, and they drove past the stuffed bear shop. They drove past this slogan actually they use is like where good pets go to heaven or something along those lines. So here this trip from point A to point B, they planted enough seeds subconsciously in their minds that they were able to basically be completely brainwashed to do what he wanted to do. Now, we have to extrapolate this, that he is, an illusionist showing us what he's doing. There are professional people out there who this is what they do from a true like marketing standpoint. Like, you take this and you apply it to a marketing. And that's why we have such an emotional appeal when we do see the red team and the blue team, the Republicans, Democrats. And frankly, Dan, it's why I'd say the yellow team, we don't have too much of an appeal at all. We don't really have an emotional response because we haven't even gotten to the level that people are really truly paying attention to us. And I mean, candidly, like what? The last time we really had a national conversation about the candidate was Gary Johnson. And that wasn't for him being the most libertarian or I'd say the best candidate. It was because they were looking for somebody, anybody beyond Trump and Hillary. And in some cases, they were trying to prop him up to take down Hillary Clinton. They were assuming he was going to take some votes from Trump. And then they started to realize, oh, no, he's taking votes from Hillary too. Oh, we probably should change course. And then they elected him. And that's exactly why I think we as libertarians, we need to stop relying on the media to be our advocates. They're not going to be. Now, we can do what Spike Cohen did. We can do what Larry Sharp did on a New York state level, go to the local media and talk to the real people one-on-one, which I think is absolutely important. But we're talking from a national perspective when we're having that national voice. We 1,000% need to have a cohesive message. And I think that cohesive message does need to be focused, yes, of libertarian principles, but it can't be out of left field libertarian principles. It has to be, again, focused on what people are talking about. So from national right now, again, lockdowns, no questions asked. That should be the number one thing on top of people's minds. Also, the economy. Like, that should be, without a doubt, one of the biggest issues. I mean, the debt didn't just go away. Like, the debt's still there. We still have millions of people unemployed because of the lockdowns. There's going to be a long-term implications that we need to deal with from that standpoint. So right now, I'd say, Dan, we have a great opportunity because I think, right now we've had in the past some hesitation to even have conversations about alternative solutions. But we even see like Republicans and conservatives are pushing against this great reset, right? That's being pushed by some folks on the left. But like, let's talk about it from the libertarian perspective. Like, we have all the answers, right? And oh my goodness, you can go to every single libertarian group on Facebook and you can find out just how right we are, right? And the solutions that we have. And I'm confident, and I'm sure you're confident as well, that those solutions will work. But now it's on our roles to help teach people, but we have to bring them in first to be taught. So I would say I encourage the salespeople to sell, bring people into the movement. And I encourage the teachers, the educators to help, like when we get libertarians here, to keep them here. I mean, Larry Sharp, he was just in my show here today, actually, he's recording on Friday. And he's like, hey, I'm a recruiter. Like, let me recruit. But no, they're not going to be libertarian. I know that. I need you to help turn them full-blown libertarian. Like, if we can get them all the way to ANCAP, let's rock and roll, right? If I can have them wearing a tax chasing this theft hat by the end of the month, like, that's thumbs up because you guys did your job. But like, once I get them there, I need you to help convert them into like a long-term client, not just like that one-time vote. And that's what we saw, right? 4 million votes, 2 million votes. They didn't stick around from 2016 and 2020. Something happened, right? So we need to get that long-term voter. And how we do that? We build value. And that, again, goes back to sales.
Right. Well, and this is interesting too, because you look at sales and marketing is not so much it's not as direct as a lot of people think it is, right? So you have let's talk about the dairy industry, right? Mm. There were Got Milk ads. They were not advertising any specific brand of milk. They were just advertising milk. And so people would, you know, they'd do their grocery shopping and they'd buy more milk than usual because they're like, you know, they associate a value with that, right? And they say, oh, milk makes your bones strong. All, you know, all this other shit, which turns out to be totally false. But they're pushing this, right? And this combined with messages from the FDA. Messages from the FDA are going into the schools telling us what a perfectly balanced diet should look like. And it just happens
your
to
food
have
pyramid.
Milk in there. Exactly. Yeah. So this is, it's not just the commercials that's on TV. And this is really important because when people look at libertarian campaigning, they like to think that, you know, oh yeah, we just get out there and we campaign and then people are going to like us and that's going to be that, right? We just have to campaign harder. We need more money for more ads and all that. But that's not it at all. No. And what I'd like to see, because look at how these other guys are actually campaigning, right? There, you have the special interest groups who are actually doing the groundwork. And this, the special interest group is how you, like, as you say, meet them where they are, right? Because there are people out there who all they care about is the minimum wage. Well, there's a special interest group called Fight for 15. And all those people, they go there, they're extremely excited. They want to go out and protest. They're going to help spread the word. They're going to donate money. They're going to do all this stuff. But if it was just a Democratic candidate who said, yeah, I'm going to fight for $15 minimum wage, they're not going to get that many volunteers. They're not going to get that many donations or anything else. Because, yeah, you want to fight for 15, but you also want to do a bunch of other stuff that I don't really understand. And yeah, maybe I support that. Maybe I'll vote for you. But more importantly, I really want to give all my money to this Fight for 15 group. Then you have Black Lives Matter. You have the NRA, which is on the other side. You have like all these organizations, right? They're very single issue. And you get people like that. And then these organizations partner with the politicians. And now all the politicians have to do is blow the dog whistle. Oh, yeah, Fight for 15. Oh, yeah, Black Lives Matter. And everyone who supports those single issue special interest groups is now, oh, well, I've been saying Black Lives Matter. I've been saying Fight for 15. I've been saying all gun laws are unconstitutional. No, the NRA doesn't say that. I've been saying these things over and over and over again. And now there's a politician who agrees with me. Oh, my God. Yep. You're already sold on this politician because of the special interest groups and you don't even know it.
Yep.
You think some politician just came along and was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to support. I believe in the same things as you. No, this is all according. It's like you say, like about this illusionist, you have the illusionists who are willing to come out and say, like, yeah, you know, this is how I manipulated you. But then you also have all these other illusionists doing this to us right now and just being completely quiet about it. So it's happening. We're being manipulated and we don't even know it unless we see it. And it's hard to see it because I mean, you can look and say, well, is that a coincidence? Maybe this new person came along and they really did just support. Like, oh yeah, that sounded like a good idea. Or maybe there's some backdoor deal going on with, like, you know, money shuffling around and all this other stuff. But this is my point is, if the Libertarian Party started doing this, like, because we have a lot of really great positions.
Yeah.
But we have so many people that come to the Libertarian Party and they're like, well, I came here because I wanted to legalize weed, but what's all this stuff about gay rights? Or I came here because I wanted lower taxes, but what's all this stuff about legalizing weed? Like, that's the thing, right?
Yep.
But if we get people, if we get, and this is the difficult thing too, or I guess this would be our advantage if we started to do this, is the special interest groups that are out there right now are very Democrat, very Republican. They're very divisive on purpose. They want to repulse the other side. Whereas a libertarian solution that says, no, we want everybody to earn a living wage, but that doesn't mean forcing employers to pay a certain amount. That means eliminating taxes so you actually get to keep the money you earn. That means lowering the cost of living. Things that neither side can have an objection to.
Right.
Then you're winning both you're winning people from both sides. It's still not the entire, you're not getting the entire audience. You're still getting a niche, but it's a niche that does not repulse anybody. So now when you blow that dog whistle, right? If Bernie Sanders gets on TV and says, yeah, fight for 15, he's going to win one side and he's going to repulse the other side. But now if a libertarian gets on TV and says, yeah, we're going to make the cost of living more affordable, and there is a special interest group that has been promoting what this actually means, that dog whistle right there is now heard by the left and the right, and they're both like, oh yeah, that's okay. And even if they don't agree with it, they're not repulsed by it.
Yeah.
And so now you do that, you blow four or five dog whistles, and you have everybody. And that doesn't come from like, oh, we've got this new person and they're going to start campaigning. No, it's as a group, we have to be pushing these ideas the whole time.
Yes.
Through all these different channels.
Yes. Well, so this has been partly why I've been having so many diverse voices over on my show, because like I think maybe too often than not, we have this mentality of like, there's like this two camp, right? The LP should be the education camp. The LP should be the electoral camp for policy, right? And it's like, it instead of being like, it's funny. It's funny. I'm thinking about this right now. I did a Star Wars podcast with Stephen Kent coming up here this Friday, where we just talked about this right now with like the Jedi and Sith. And like talking about like how the Jedi had this like crazy mentality that like to bring balance to the Force, it meant destroying all the Sith. And it's like, that's not balance, right? So like, that's what you see right now. Instead of having like this yin and yang, where it's you have to have like that kind of like a give and take, it ends up being like this all or nothing approach. So what happens is you have some folks who like entirely focus on electoral politics, and then you have 2016 happen, and then nobody sticks around. But then you have some people who are more focused on building up actual libertarian branding and you know, activism, right? And then that, I would say, maybe we're going to see some people stick around longer from Joe Jorgensen, right? Fingers crossed. And we're seeing, I think, right now, more of an approach to say we need to have both. And I just had Larry Sharp here on the show today, and we discussed this, activism versus being a candidate. There is a role for both, but you can't be both at the same time. Only very rarely can that work. So the difference, right, is to your point, Dan, you have the fight for 15 folks, right? Or you have, you know, pro-life folks, March for Life folks. Like, if that's your one issue, right, you're an activist. And if you're trying to get into that world, right, then you're going to be digging into that activist role, and you're going to be focusing on that one issue. But you're going to be approaching it from a libertarian perspective, right? But the candidate's job is not to be an activist. The candidate's job is to get attention, right? So when you're a candidate, it's going to come across to your activists as they're not pure enough. They're not radical enough, right? They need to be screaming the radical message, which is true to an extent, though, because there's like a level where we have to remember we're like at a 10, and your average person is like a negative 2. So we have to at least like bring our message down to like a 6 or a 5 just to even like be in the ballpark of them paying attention to us. Cause otherwise we turn into the guy in the corner of the street with the blowhorn screaming at people as they walk by. And that just doesn't win people's attention. I think actually you and I discussed this when you were on my show back when you were running. Right. So I'm hoping that we're going to see more of, and again, we now have the educational pieces in place. We have the activist roles in place. I don't care if you're a Cato person or a Mises person, right? We have those kind of institutions that are there to help the educational part, build up the activist base. Awesome. And then the activists be activists. But then also we need to let the candidate roles be candidates, but be true to the principles that the activists are speaking about. But activists also know they can't, you know, go full on, you know, level 10 libertarianism. You can't do that. It's not going to be able to resonate. And I hear everybody say, well, Ron Paul did it. Well, Ron Paul pretty much is like what? The only libertarian that we've been able to identify in the past 40 years that pretty much coalesced everybody for, albeit a short time. He did coalesce us. There was a unifying figure, a leader of some sort. And now we see it fizzle apart again. So I'm hoping that we're going to see an understand and a fundamental understanding, right? That we need to have this yin and yang. We can't have the Jedi crushing the Sith. You need to have the balance in the Force, right? No, we don't need a Rey with her yellow lightsaber, but we do need to have an understanding that because you are an activist, that does not mean that you cannot support a candidate, right? That does not scream your ideals. But to the contrary, just because you're a candidate and you don't want to necessarily, you know, be 100% a radical, that doesn't mean you just shun those different voices away. You need to have them as a part of your coalescing base. And I think that's where, you know, we need, as libertarians, we need to be focused on building more coalitions within libertarianism, within our own libertarian circles to begin with. Because right now, we don't have enough people in our ranks to be so divisive and so rigid in our, you know, who is allowed in our club to be pushing people out. You know, I don't expect everybody to be a perfect libertarian when they start, you know, investigating into libertarianism. That's expected. Like, was anybody a pure libertarian ever when they were born? I don't think so. And if you were, like, God bless you. Like, I think you're the only one. But that's the point, is we need to make sure that we're not approaching people the way that we would not have wanted them approached when we are starting our libertarian journey. We need to be those people who are willing to say, hey, listen, hold my hand. I'm going to walk you through. It's going to be a little intense. You know, we're going to go a couple down rabbit holes, some Ron Paul videos about him leaving Congress and stuff. It's going to be good. But we'll get you through this, and I'm going to hand you off to some really good people who are going to teach you about the really nitty-gritty stuff. Like if you want to start going in, you know, down whatever rabbit hole, you want to talk about the Federal Reserve, you go ahead and you give them Ron Paul's book. You want to go ahead and talk about name it, right? You want to talk about the anatomy of the state, you give them some Rothbard. You want to talk about market principles, give them some Hayek. Well, I don't care. Or Milton Friedman. We need to be building these coalitions instead of fighting each other. And because honestly, like, what does it solve? If, like, you're right, great. I don't want to be the king of people being right. Like, I want to actually see people get liberty enacted in their lives, because we know the value of it. We know it makes people's lives better. So, like, put our personal vanity aside. Stop trying to be right all the time. Like, great. If you're right, thumbs up. I'll say you're right too, but help me advance liberty. Let's actually get some stuff done.
Right. And you make a lot of good points here. And, you know, I'm always knocking on libertarians too, but, you know, there's, you know, to say, well, Ron Paul did it. Yeah, he did it. He also did it as a Republican, which if any libertarian does that, they're like automatically, oh, you're a bad person. You're a deserter. You're, you know, you don't even support. You're not a real libertarian, right?
Yep.
And it's like, but he did it. And you look at Arya DeMezio, who ran for sheriff in a constituency that absolutely hated her for it. She's a total, I think she calls herself an anarchist, ran for sheriff as a Republican and got, or at least she won the primary. So she's now the officially the Republican candidate. And it's like, it worked. And not only that, she got a shit ton of attention over that. And it's like this stuff works. Like, we need to stop, like, you know, it's, and it's ironic too, because you look at, you know, you look at, like, some people, oh, you can't fix it from the inside, so don't join the Republican Party. And, well, it's like, well, then why does the Libertarian Party exist at all if you can't fix it from the inside? Because they're just trying to do it at a different level to a different
right
organization.
Yeah. We can't fix it from the inside, but we're going to fix government from the inside. Gotcha. Yep.
Right. But and at the same time, to anyone who even says you can't fix it from the inside, since you already brought up Star Wars, the Death Star was an inside job.
It was, exactly.
And if you're a conspiracy theorist, 9/11 was an inside job. Like, try telling a termite.
Alex Jones,
you cannot take
that?
Yeah. You cannot take down that house from the inside, and a termite comes along and says, hold my beer, right? Like, you can do a lot from the inside. The problem is, one, getting your foot in the door, and two, getting your foot in the door and then actually sticking to what you were going to do, or getting enough people in the door to help you. Which, yeah, it's not an easy task. The Trojan horse. I mean, so many examples where, yes, you can, if you can get inside, you can do some damage. But that's the trick, is getting inside.
Well, look at Thomas Massie, right? Like, Thomas Massie, belly of the beast. He is a small L libertarian as a Republican, and he's gotten a lot of flack. I mean, I know former Chairman Sarwark was going after him back when he was, you know, at the time running, I think, for a re-election. And I think it was something, a little snipe he had there, because Massie was going after Liz Cheney because Liz Cheney endorsed his primary opponent. And it's like, why are we going after our one, like one of our few allies that we have, who's a small L libertarian in Congress. And yet Thomas Massie, like, if we did not have Thomas Massie in Congress, would we have seen all the politicians go back to Congress and vote on that initial spending bill? So now we have names next to the vote. I don't think so. But like, am I not libertarian for acknowledging that was done by a Republican? Like, I'm sorry. Like, that's just objective fact. And I think it's, I mean, like, am I a bad libertarian for saying that good job, Rand Paul, for keeping us out of war in Iran? Like, I'm sorry. I don't think that that's a bad thing. And like, we do have to like let libertarians know the dirty little secret. Politics is a real thing. It's going to happen whether we're playing the game or not. And actually, I think it's Jason Stapleton who brought this up. He's like, that's why, like, you know, his show is Wealth, Power, and Influence, because like, people are influencing you as it is. Like, you should be a person who knows how to influence others, because it's happening right now. So shouldn't you be using it for good? Like, it is right. Like, yes, we have personal autonomy, but we also have personal responsibility. You know, like, we have to take initiative and lead by example, because if we're not leading by example, then like, what are we doing? Like, again, are we just trying to be right in our little echo chambers? Like, I truly see this, Dan. We're seeing right now, social media is breaking us apart into these little silos. And this is really scary, because once you go into these little silos and like the doors close, like, you're not talking to people anymore. You're talking to your hive. And when you're talking to your hive, groupthink is a really dangerous psychological, I call it really a psychological disease, because bad ideas, just because they have a 50 plus 1% approval from that group, become policy. And then when they become policy, they start to have, you know, real implications on the other 49% that didn't vote for it. And that's really scary, because then those hives start to get more and more segregated. And that's, it's, you have all these little individual hives. And like, what's the point? Like, are we supposed to, like, are we encouraging that, like, to go into this weird segmented world? I hope not, because like, we have to live with each other. I dare say that's what we're supposed to be aiming for. Like, how do we live with each other and the ironic coexist bumper sticker, you know, on the van that's on fire. Right. But like, at the same, like, I want to be tolerant, but I also like need you to let me like you yourself need to tolerate. Like, it needs to be, again, that give and take. We can't have it be all or another. And I think it starts with us leading by example, trying to get people kind of back to having conversations versus entering these. It's like, you shouldn't always be going to look for a debate, right? Like, that what does that accomplish? If you're going in guns ablaze, like, I and going back to sales, right? I have never seen a good sales call start out by saying, let me tell you why the solution you have in place right now sucks, right? Like, that does not work, because then you're like, you're attacking almost that person, because that person probably made that decision to buy that, right? And the same thing is true when you're like, I'm going to start this conversation by debating you. You're instantly starting off by saying, I think you're wrong. And it's like, how about this? Let's maybe rewind. And let's start asking some questions to figure out where we actually agree, and maybe we're both right, and then build on those things that we're right and find out where the separation happens. And I'm going to almost guarantee 9 times out of 10, you're going to find that the point where the person like breaks off towards, you know, whatever it is that they end up, It's something that happened in their life. It's their lived experience. And I know we see, you know, too often people say we can't just keep talking about lived experiences and empathy because, you know, it leads you down a path that's talking way too much about, you know, feelings and it's not based on reality. But like at the end of the day, people's lived experiences, it frames their worldview and it frames how they interact with their communities, their environments, and also each other. And if we're not acknowledging that that fundamental reality is something that like all of us experience, then like we're ignoring what it means to be human and how we understand and learn from each other. So like we have to, you know, get out of the mindset that we're just right and have to ask again what it is that is making people tick. Why do you believe what you believe? And then we have to peel back that onion, kind of reconstruct the argument and get the person to help realize that maybe there's something that they didn't necessarily see before that now they see. Like we have to plant a seed of liberty, but when you plant a seed, it's not going to grow overnight. Like that's not how it works. You can't just like say like I got you and now you're a libertarian because I was right. Like, that's not how it works. When you see that like, you have that aha moment, like you have to step away and let them process it on their own. And again, it goes back to like, we just can't be going into these conversations wanting to be right. We have to be wanting to actually make like long lasting change, be it through policy, be it through getting people to vote the way we want them to vote, to think the way we want them to think. But again, it goes back to building value, meeting people where they're at and actually engaging in trying to be problem solvers instead of just telling people why we're right.
Right. And going back to, I have so many things to say about what you just said, but let me try to touch a couple. But then I want to go to the feelings of sales. But first I want to touch on the point that you said about, you know, the internet separating us into hives, which is really interesting because we were kind of already separated into hives. Before the internet, like you got everyone in Los Angeles living in Los Angeles, everybody in Iowa living in Iowa, and hardly ever communicating with each other. And then the internet comes along, and all of a sudden, we've got friends all over the world, which is amazing. But now it's like we're being separated ideologically instead of geographically into these separate little clusters. And then when we go out in the world, it's like, okay, yeah, we might not talk about politics when we go out to buy our groceries. We just say, hi, how's it going? How's the weather? And you know, you see somebody wearing a MAGA hat and you get triggered and it's like, oh my God, that person shouldn't exist in my universe. It's
so true.
Yeah, it's absolutely insane. But that does help facilitate that, and I think to some extent we probably were healthier when we weren't in those, when we were in the geographic bubbles, because at least in the geographic bubbles the communities that we were in were still pretty diverse, and we still had diverse conversations and different people, which brings me to the point about being open-minded. We always have to be open-minded, and like I'm constantly doing this and reminding myself to question everything that I do. Every time I say taxation is theft and like somebody actually like challenges me on that, I actually listen to their question and question myself. Is it possible that I'm wrong? And every time I come to the conclusion, no, taxation is absolutely still theft. But yeah, they do have a really good point. This other thing that they're talking about is a really interesting problem that is being solved with taxes. And if we got rid of taxes, it would make that problem worse. So maybe we have to figure out a way that I can help to solve that problem. And that goes into what you're talking about. Like we have to be engaged and we have to be leaders.
Yes.
Because there are so many libertarians and anarchists who are just like, well, that's not my job. I don't want to be a leader. I don't want to have to teach people this and that. And it's like, okay, that's fine. You can just, that's not your obligation. You don't have to do anything.
Right.
But do you want to live in a world with a bunch of people who want to run around stealing your shit? And do you really want to have the threat that if the dollar collapses because the Federal Reserve overprinted one day, that you're going to be on your front porch wondering if you've got enough bullets for like this like zombie apocalypse of people coming to steal all the food that you have in your refrigerator? Like, do you want to deal with that? Or would you rather just spend like, you know, 5 minutes of your spare time or just, you know, walk around with a taxation theft hat or, you know, do what little piece you can just to spread a little bit of knowledge and make the world a little bit more free so that you won't have to come to that. And I know some people kind of fantasize about getting to that point and how awesome it's going to be.
That's not going to be. It won't be, I promise.
But then, okay, so then I also want to talk about the feeling of sales, because we're talking about we're talking about how do we get people interested in this idea of liberty, right? And yep. there is this great neurological researcher who did this amazing study. I can't think of the name or anything, but you can Google it and find it pretty easily. Where basically there was they did a study on groups of people who had the part of their brain that controls their emotions had been damaged, and they had no emotions. And they asked them to make simple decisions. Would you prefer chocolate or vanilla ice cream? Which one of these cars is better for you? And right. They would give them like ones that's economical and one that's a sports car or something like that, right? And right. they could not even say this or that. They would just sit there staring, I can't decide. And what they realize is that we make every single decision is absolutely emotional.
Yeah.
And to anybody who says, no, I'm a perfectly logical person, all of my decisions are made logically. No, that is an emotion that you have.
Yes.
That's like, I'm in love with being a logical person, and yep. I can justify every single decision I make with logic. But the reality is, if it's chocolate or vanilla, you can make all, like, I pick vanilla. You can make a million rational explanations as to why you pick vanilla. Oh, if I spill it on the floor, it's not going to be as messy. Or, you know, it's not gonna, like, you could come up with a million reasons. But the same thing is true of chocolate. You can come up with a million different reasons. And so all you're doing is you're trying to justify an emotional decision that you already made. So now when we're talking about liberty, and we're talking about, like, how do we get people to fall in love with this idea of liberty, right? Because there are two things in sales and marketing that they teach you, which is fear and sex, right? I mean, not directly sex. They always say sex sells, but what is sex? It's just pleasure, right? And so what are you selling? You're either selling fear or pleasure. That's it, right? Why? When have you ever bought anything except for fear or pleasure, right? Anything. Think about it. When have you bought? Oh, you bought a new car? That was pleasure. Felt good, didn't yep. it? Oh, you took your car to the repair shop and you bought new brakes? Oh, they might have told you, well, if you don't fix these now, your brakes are going to fail and you're going to fall, you run off the road. Like yep. fear and pleasure. These are the two things. And so when a lot of politicians right now, they're using fear, right? Oh, don't vote for the other guy because he's going to destroy the economy and kill your mother. So vote for me, right? That's yep. fear versus pleasure. Vote for me. I'm going to give you $15 an hour. I'm going to give you free healthcare. I'm going to give you free education. That's pleasure. So what are the libertarians doing? Because the libertarians mostly like to say, oh, Federal Reserve. Well, which is fear a little bit. But that's not really connected to me, is it? Because, like, right. if the Federal Reserve is, like, overprinting inflation, I don't have a lot of money in savings. Am I really going to, like, yeah, it's these are evil guys and I want to see them go away. But how does this really affect my voting decisions? That does not affect my day-to-day decisions. But, like, I can be pissed off as hell about the Federal Reserve, but I got to go to my job tomorrow and they're paying me $7 an hour. And Bernie Sanders is telling me he's going to give me 15. Well, that's a more immediate concern. That's a more attractive pleasure to me, or a more real fear of having to pay my rent than, you know, the Federal Reserve, which is so distant and so huge that even if I voted for a libertarian, it's probably not going to change anything. So if you really want to get these people and win them over, you have to start offering them something that they can look at and say, yeah, wait, this actually makes sense, and it affects me directly. It's something I very intimately, closely care about that directly affects my life, and it's not that big of a thing that we can actually probably change it. And this is why they say vote, you know, we have better luck in the local elections, because yeah, those are, it doesn't take, like, oh, we can get this guy elected with only 5,000 votes? Okay, well, right. Let's do that, and let's try this out. Let's see if it works. Okay, I think I covered all my points there, but I didn't see. I hate doing this. Like when you're going off and you're like naming all these like amazing things, I'm like, okay, I don't want to interrupt, man, because like I don't know where he's going, but this is good stuff.
Trust me, I the same thing happens to me at my show because like I'll have a guest on and they'll be going through and I ask. So when I ask a question, it's not like a yes or no question or like a you know a quick little like here's a quick aside. It's like a here's a 13 part question that I'm gonna break down, and also each 13 parts has like three ABC parts to it as well. And the guest is always like, wow, that's a lot to break down. I'm like, I know, I'm sorry. But no, I completely empathize. But like the reality is that at the end of the day, like everything we're doing, we have to acknowledge there is that good feeling to it, right? And I was actually just talking about this, I think it was a couple weeks ago. I forget who was on my show and I brought this up. But like even when you help the old lady cross the street, like you might think like I'm doing that out of the kindness of my heart, but like, no, you're doing it because like, you know, it's the right thing to do, and doing the right thing makes you feel good. So to your point, yes, it's the pleasure. You're triggering that pleasure center. And actually it goes beyond just like a thought, like, you know, pleasure versus fear. There's actually like hormones that are, you know, related to this, like your dopamine center. When you enact pleasure, the receptors go off and your body's like, ooh, that felt good. Right. And that's partly, I think, what we have to also address when we're
drug addicts.
We are. Everybody's doing some type of drug when they wake up in the morning, whether it's coffee or just pleasure receptors. You know, at the end of the day, we need to acknowledge that is how it really we all function. So if we're libertarians, to your point, right, like how do we relate to the people? Like, again, lockdowns, fear, you're going to like you think the government has the right to tell you that your job isn't essential? And with that your family's life isn't essential? Like, I'm sorry, that's not the case. And I would dare say that your average person would be empathetic to that argument. Then and to the pleasure center, hey, listen, and I every time Andrew Yang will say, like, I think we need to give another $1,000 to the American people every single month. I'm like, how about you stop taking $1,000 from my paycheck every single month? Let's start there. Like, let's just do the inverse of it. Can we start there? Is it like a common starting off point? And like, that's the argument we need to have, because that's more money in my paycheck because they're not taking it from it to begin with. And like, I think, again, we can start to make those again, pleasure receptor arguments. But again, it's focusing on the things that actually matter to the person, right? And what's going to, again, be your bedbug problem? What's the main thing that's bothering the most? If we can solve that problem, we are then going to be their trusted confidant. So I just had on my show Kevin Vallier. He's an associate professor associate professor of philosophy. There we go. Over in a Bowling Green University. And he just wrote a book called Trust in a Polarized Age. And it's funny because I've been seeing this reoccurring theme over the past few weeks in my show that trust. We are a society that's fundamentally lacking in trust. And libertarians have a great opportunity right now to be trusted advisors, because people are looking, and this is just a sad reality, and I forget who did this interview. There was a lady that was on, and I think she was talking to a Catholic priest, and she was, you know, saying, you know, when what she wanted out of life, and she ended up like breaking down in her going through what she wanted, because it ended up she wanted to be told what to do. She wanted to be told who to love, who to vote for, what to believe, you know what to wear, what to eat, because she felt that everything that she had done for her own deciding in life ended up being wrong, and it ended up not getting her in the position she wants. And she even acknowledged in her you know breaking down as she's going through this that she knew that the people that she's asking for the help and the guidance, that they're full of shit too, that they're giving, you know, fake suggestions or fake advice just to keep the masses happy. But they're doing it because these people, they reflect that, well, they have a good life, or, you know, they say that they know what they're talking about. We're trusting the experts. And it's sad because your average person does kind of want, they have that desire to like, hey, can you just like tell me what's going on? Right. And I think we have a chance now to be that trusted advisor, but it requires us to initially enter into their lives as, again, the person who's going to solve that bedbug problem. What is it that's going to be bothering them? And how can we apply libertarian principles to that bedbug problem? So I challenge libertarian candidates or libertarian activists, like, if you're in your community and you know that like your biggest issue is like the trash collection in your community, and it's like, you know, you have rats running around because the trash is not getting collected, then make that, like, if you're a libertarian candidate, that is your issue. You are the trash collection on time guy. Like, that is your, every campaign is focused around you talking about that, because guess what? Whether you're left, you're right, I don't care what you are, you're going to be like, he's got a point. Like, the trash collection is a big issue. And at the very least, you will then raise enough attention that it starts to get talked about. And then when it's being talked about, then we can offer solutions, right? But and kind of that's why Trump is so, you know, brilliant sometimes in his tweets, because his tweets make people talk about things that they otherwise wouldn't be talking about, right? I think that right now, while we are a smaller party, that is the Libertarian Party's role. We have to kind of be like the party that keeps the Republicans and Democrats talking about the things that they probably wouldn't otherwise talk about. Republicans, get them talking about free market economics, especially now with Biden being president, I think going into 2021, right? Get them talking about free markets and keeping them fiscally conservative. And if you're going for more of the left, keep those Democrats on criminal justice reform. Get them to focus on ending qualified immunity. Like, make that an issue that we're going to push them on, and make those bed bug issues things that we can coalesce on. Because then, when we can plant our seed of messaging into those respective communities, we're building trust with them. And then when the time comes that, like, they start to say, okay, listen, I see that things aren't working in name, you know, if you're talking to a lefty, like, I know the economics right now aren't working, and I know that we agree on this, and talk to me about the economic stuff. Like, I trust you on this. Talk to me about this. That's where we're going to have inroads. But it doesn't start until we build that level of trust. And it again, requires us entering into those conversations, trying to be genuinely, like, curious in how we can help solve those problems, and then actually offer lasting solutions.
Right. And so there's a couple things that I picked up on here. And so, one, you talk about experts coming in and people not, like, there's this, people get stuck, right? They don't want to make decisions. And this is a fear, right? People are afraid to make the wrong decision. But if there's an expert somewhere that's going to tell them, oh, no, this is the right decision, people will, it's not that they're necessarily blindly following them, even though that does happen, but it's easier for them to do something when the, you know, what's the possible repercussions of that is, it's the wrong decision. Somebody needs to be held responsible. Well, if I didn't make the decision and I'm following somebody else's decision, I'm not going to be held responsible. Right. They gave me the wrong information. They're going to be held. So it relieves the responsibility for myself, which makes it an easier decision to be made, which, yep. You know, and this is one of the, we're always talking about self-responsibility within libertarians, but I think it's really, really important to acknowledge that this is what's going on. And I want to say this too, that, you know, as we're having this conversation, I just realized something that's like, you know, it's like totally going to change, you know, my direction in how I try to pitch things too. And this is what I mean by, like, always question yourself and always question if what you're doing is right. Because as we're talking about like fear and pleasure, is I find pleasure in defying the government. So when the governor comes on TV and says, oh yeah, you have to wear a mask. I was in the airport in Houston for a layover, and, like, as I'm walking through the airport, on the speakers they say like, the governor has passed an executive order that all residents must wear masks, blah blah blah. And I was like, well, I'm not a fucking resident, so I guess I don't have to wear it. And it's interesting because the government really specifically chooses the right words for these things a lot of times. You know, they don't just say, like, why wouldn't they just say everybody? Like, somebody actually decided we're going to say residents instead, which is bullshit. But I find pleasure in saying, hey, you know what? Your executive orders don't apply to me in the first place, because that's not what an executive order is, not a law. And right. Yes, you can order people in your chain of command to wear masks, but you can't order me to wear a mask. So I find pleasure in finding ways to defy the government. But to other people, that's a very scary proposition.
Yep.
So while I can be saying here, like, oh yeah, this is amazing, you got to try this, they're just hearing, like, oh my God, this guy's crazy. Like, I better take a few steps back in case, like, the FBI kicks the door down and starts shooting at him any minute now. And I think we have to realize that as libertarians, that whenever we're trying to say things like this, and I know, like, we, like, it's really hard for me to even put myself back in that position. But I remember, like, the first time when I was just like, I was looking online for, like, I remember, like, I heard it was at that Trump Academy thing. They were having a thing, and, like, this guy was, like, teaching, oh yeah, I'm gonna give me $5,000 and I'll teach you how to not pay taxes. And then this old guy gets up with his cane, and he's like, income tax is unconstitutional. And he storms out of the room. And so I was like, well, fuck this. I went to go follow that guy. I didn't find him, but I was, like, on the internet for the rest of the week, you know, income tax unconstitutional, trying to find whatever I could. And I remember, like, even being afraid to type that into Google. Like, yeah. Oh my God, they're tracking all this shit. I remember being afraid. I remembered, like, making posts on social media and, like, being afraid to share videos that were, like, on YouTube, like Zeitgeist and the Freedom to Fascism document. Like, that was real fear. And now I understand that there's really nothing to be afraid of. So I can go out here and say all these things, and I totally forget how fearful I was, and that all these other people that I'm talking to, they still have that same fear. And we have to help them over that. And this is kind of like, you know, your point about being, you know, up here at 10 and they're down there at -2. Like, yeah, if they see me coming, they see Alex Jones coming, they're like, oh my God, keeping my distance here. We definitely do need to ease that fear. And there's a lot of information and education that goes into getting people over that hump of fear. It's not like you're going to sit there and have a 5-second conversation with them. I mean, it's like, you know, hey, come with me, jump in, fly this airplane. People are going to be scared shitless. But if they go through, like, a few classes, if they fly a couple times with, like, an instructor next to them, like, that's going to get them over that hump of fear. But there's nothing you could say to a person in 5 minutes that's going to convince them, with absolutely no knowledge on how to even turn the plane on, that he can jump in there and fly the thing. He'd be scared shitless. So I think that's a great analogy, but, like, I think this is absolutely important.
For sure. And really quick too, like, that's why people care about a resume. Like, for better or for worse, like, people are looking at their politicians and they want to see what you've done. And like, that's why I'm not saying that that's how it should be, but that's how it is right now, especially in the you know, duopoly we have for our political system. So, like, instead of pretending that shouldn't be the case, and we're just gonna like fight through it, like, okay, but, like, we actually need to, like, take that into consideration when we're running candidates, right? And, like, we have to be different when we're running local, and, like, let the local candidates, when they get elected, build the resume. Like, go from, like, dog catcher to school board to city council to county legislator to assembly, state senate, and then all of a sudden people in your community know that they can trust you, right? They're like, hey, yeah, that Bob, the state senator, that's Bob the dog catcher who went through all those different roles, and I know Bob the dog catcher because Bob the dog catcher was, you know, my next door neighbor, right? That's how you build up the credibility and the trust that, honestly, we absolutely need to build with people from an electoral standpoint, especially. So, I mean, we need to encourage people to really run local. But when you're running local, again, focus on those bed bug issues for your communities and actually offer real lasting liberty solutions to those bed bug problems, become the trusted advisor, build the resume, and then that will set us up for actually, like, real lasting electoral success. And we're going to see it happen sooner rather than later. We had, like, how many head-to-heads against incumbent duopoly candidates? We had Ricky Dale Harrington Jr. go against Tom Cotton solo, mano a mano in Arkansas. You had Todd Hagopian go against, I forget the gentleman's name, but for Oklahoma Corporation Commission, one-on-one. And we've seen this, right? Whenever we have the one-on-one candidates, we at least are able to get our names out there. Tom Cotton didn't even want to debate Ricky on stage. So Ricky had a pretty much an entire C-SPAN, you know, campaign ad. And I mean, like, good for Ricky. That's an opportunity for us to talk to people about the bedbug issues. So, like, when we have those chances, goodness, take advantage of it. And then in the meantime, use folks like, you know, myself, like you, who have platforms to get our message out there. Take, you know, that's why I have, like, local candidates on my show. I'm like, here, get your opportunity to get, like, your pitch out there to people, because I know how hard it is to get your message out there beyond the media. Like, And I get really frustrated when there are libertarian candidates who are like, ah, I'm not going to go on a podcast. I'm like, okay, good luck getting into your local paper for that one ad, right? Whereas you can take this and you can grab a soundbite and you can make that a viral campaign ad. You can sponsor it on Facebook and reach thousands more eyes. But again, we have to change the way also, you know, from podcasts and stuff, the way that we're presenting ourselves. So, you know, folks, if you're running for office, don't look at campaigns. Your campaign is like above podcasting. Like, that's exactly where you need to be going, because not only are podcasts like, you know, being the growing mountain of millions of downloads that they are every single month, it's expected to exponentially rise over the next 10 years. So like, you're going to see the folks who are like building those relationships now and like getting the inroads with audiences, that's going to give them more of a chance to build trust. And that's why like Joe Rogan, like I cannot encourage folks enough, like to try and get friends to listen to podcasts like him, right? Because he's bringing on folks who, I don't care if you're 100%, you know, Larry Sharp or Dave Smith, but they're both, you know, great voices for libertarianism. And he had them both on. How many other like millions and millions of download plus podcasters or just voices out there in the media are actively having libertarian voices on for like 3-hour conversations that allow us to really dig deep into candidly conversations that need that time? I mean, how often do we see, you know, 3 minutes, you know, you have Dave Smith will be on Fox and Friends, or he'll be on Kennedy, and it's like you have 3 minutes to get your point across against three panelists that don't agree with you at all, versus you get to have a 3.5-hour conversation with a guy who doesn't agree with you on maybe like half the stuff, and you can dig into the reasons of why and find common ground. Like, that's going to be the way that you're going to see local candidates especially build trust. And I'm seeing it. Like, I had a local guy on my show. He was running for New York State Assembly, and he came on my show, and like, I had people from my home community who he was running in that district message me saying like, hey, I actually didn't know this about Mark, like in they name a certain policy, or I didn't know this was happening. Like, thank you for having that conversation, because otherwise our newspapers, they weren't covering it. And it's like, there you go. That's our role. Like, we are not like playing the role of gatekeepers or journalists, but like, we're kind of like serving that role when it's being not served by the traditional gatekeepers that are there right now. So like, I encourage, again, more local candidates, get involved, reach out. And there are nonprofits out there that are supporting non-traditional candidates, especially candidates who are getting money out of politics. I serve on a board, it's a Trailblazers PAC, and they like support any candidate, nonpartisan, just if they will show like their money in politics. Like, they'll open the books and you'll show your candidate records and you're a local candidate and you're not going to have any dark money. They'll support you. They'll endorse you in a heartbeat. And like, they're a nonpartisan organization. Like, we need more organizations like that. So I encourage folks, again, if you, and especially from my perspective, if you like, they want to learn more about that, obviously reach out to me. So I'd be more than happy to put them in contact. But I mean, that this libertarian podcasting network we have too, it's like, this is, I think, the future for libertarian media. Is it's not the traditional gatekeepers of, you know, the traditional libertarian media organizations. It's going to be the independent media. It's going to be the Lions of Liberties, the We Are Libertarians. It's going to be the Part of the Problems and the Dave Smiths and the Jason Stapletons. It's going to be the those organizations, kind of their networks all kind of interconnecting. And we see that across the board as it is right now. That's going to be really how we continue to grow. It's this organic, natural growth of these networks growing together, the audience is growing together. And you actually mentioned something very interestingly, like how it used to be that those silos were geographic, right? But now the silos are kind of going more towards ideological. And I was originally thinking like, maybe that's a bad thing, but I don't know, maybe it's also a good thing, because we're learning that the ideas that were considered to be like the mainstream idea of your home community, maybe that's not the case. Like, there's actually the 50% of people who aren't talking out there that aren't voting, they probably agree with you. And I think partly is that libertarians haven't been good leaders. If you're a good leader and you're openly saying like, here, this is what I believe, don't hurt people and don't take their stuff, or taxation is theft. And the people who also were like, yeah, like I kind of agree with that, right? Now they feel like, oh, I can say that. Like, and that's, again, kind of why Trump got so much support from Republicans, because like, they were like, he's saying the part that we need him to say. And they liked that. And that's, again, that's to the point. That's, I think, libertarians, we need to now serve that role. So, man, I'm hoping we're building some inroads now, and I'm hoping that those long lasting conversations will turn into some long lasting supporters of liberty. They'll help us get policy enacted across the world and actually make people's lives more pro liberty and ultimately better, right? That's the whole point of what we're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Man, awesome. This was a great talk, man.
Yeah, it was a blast.
Definitely, I gotta have you back on this show. I'll do your show more often. This is a great talk. And I'm sure we could keep going on. We could make this a 3.5-hour show. Does Joe Rogan, like, is that his like standard podcast time now? 3.5 hours?
I was scrolling through my podcast catcher, and he had Tom Green on his show. It was 4 hours and 49 minutes. And I was like, Tom wow. Green, like Freddie got fingered Tom Green for 4.5 hours. Yeah. So I guess so. I mean, good for him. Like that's a marathon, but
he had Dave Chappelle and somebody else. And it was about something like that. 4 hours, maybe.
It's exhausting, man. Good for him though. Good for him. Like that's why he's got the number one download podcast, I think, in the world, yeah. Isn't it? He's built up an empire. Good for him.
Absolutely. Awesome. Well, it's been awesome having you on the show. I want to give you an opportunity to plug your show and anything else, any other projects or anything you're working on. Go for it.
Floor for sure. Yours. Thanks, man. Yeah. So folks can obviously follow me over on all social media. So I'm active Twitter, Facebook, but also I do minds.com and Parler recently as well. So you can find me at B Nichols Liberty. And then the show, The Brian Nichols Show. Yes, as you mentioned in the intro, they aptly name The Brian Nichols Show. It's easy to find BrianNicholsShow.com. Right now we're around 162, I think, episodes total. I've had the show for around 3 years and I've had amazing guests ranging from, yes, the host here, Dan Taxation, is Steph Berman, all the way to candidates like Larry Sharp, and he's running for office in 2018, to now serving as a podcast host at the Sharp Way, Joe Jorgensen, Justin Amash, Thomas Massey, Glenn Jacobs, Mark Loebliner. There's so many great folks I've had in this show. And really the whole point of the show, how do we focus on selling liberty effectively to people? I'm having people on from all different political means of thought, having conversations about the issues that people care about, right? Talking about the issues that are the bed bug problems. So folks can go ahead, follow again. It's The Brian Nichols Show, Apple Podcasts. If they are interested and they like what they hear, I would definitely appreciate a subscribe. And definitely if they give me the subscribe, the 5-star rating and review would be much appreciated. So otherwise, Dan, it's been an absolute blast, man. Thank you so much for having me on the show, and definitely going to be having you on in the future for sure as well. I think this conversation, it's one that it needs to be constant. It can't be every election cycle. We got to keep the sales cycle churning. There's no off season for liberty.
Absolutely. And of course, head on over to taxationistheft.info and get all your info on not paying taxes. Get your awesome hats and swag and everything. Support us. Keep the show on the air. Keep us distributing our counter propaganda all around the world and fighting to end taxation for everybody. Because don't you want to live in a tax-free society? I think that would be fucking amazing.
Oh, man.
All right, guys. Thanks so much. Brian, thanks again. And we'll see you next time. Taxation is theft.